I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. When your kidneys fail, there are two types of treatment, dialysis or transplant. According to the National Kidney Foundation, more than 3,000 new patients are added to the kidney wait list each month. Joining us in our Woods Hole studio is Dr. Anil Chandraker, Medical Director of Kidney and Pancreas Transplantation at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and he's the President of the American Society of Transplantation. Welcome to the program. And Hanu Singh, who underwent a kidney transplant last summer. Good to see you, Hanu.
Thank you.
Dr. Chandraker, Brigham and Women's Hospital has a long history with kidney transplants. In fact, the first successful organ transplant was at your hospital. So when was the first kidney transplant? And talk about some of the work that led up to that moment.
So the first transplant was actually done in 1954, and it was carried out between identical twins. And the reason for that is that, you know, if you have two people who are identical, you don't need to tame the immune system, so you don't need to be on immunosuppressive drugs to prevent rejection. So the first series of transplants that were actually done were in these identical twins where one had kidney failure and the other one didn't, and the one who didn't obviously donated to the one who did. And that really established the whole operation successfully. And it's only after that that we started to think about immunosuppression when we wanted to transplant non-identical individuals.
And we've come a long way since 1954, haven't we, in this
Absolutely.
Process? So let's talk a little bit about the role of the kidneys in our bodies.
So the kidneys are there to eliminate waste. Actually, the kidneys are a very complex organ because they don't just eliminate waste, they control your bone metabolism, the acid-base balance in the body. They're also responsible for production of red cells. And so they do a number of different jobs. They also filter out toxins. And so when we think about kidneys, we just think about making urine, and it sounds so simple. But it is actually a highly complex organ. And unlike other organs, so the liver, for example, is a number of repeating units. So it's built on these identical units that are repeated. The kidney is not like that. So you can take part of a liver, and it'll work like a liver, only on a much smaller level. But the kidney won't do that. It all has to be integrated. And one of the problems with that is that when the kidneys start to fail, you cannot regrow your kidney, unlike your liver, where you can reestablish some function. So some organs, like the kidney and the brain, are difficult to for them to regenerate. Whereas other organs, you have excess capacity, and you can compensate somewhat. Having said that, we do have two kidneys, and you're perfectly safe to live on just one kidney.
Yeah. So this would explain why, when we talk about the wait list for all kinds of organ transplantation, the kidneys are the number one. I think 82% on the list are waiting for kidneys.
Correct. So yeah. Kidneys is the largest number of transplants that are done in the United States and, in fact, the world.
And we have over 100,000 people on the wait list, and we do, about 12,000 kidney surgeries a year?
Correct. Something like this all kidney transplantation, both from deceased donation and from living donors.
All right. So what are some of the symptoms that the kidneys are not functioning correctly? What do we say? Because there's lots of different reasons people's kidneys fail, correct?
Correct. And, you know, unfortunately, even while you have fairly advanced kidney disease, you may not feel any symptoms at all. But most of the symptoms occur with advanced kidney disease, and it's tiredness. It can be shortness of breath. You can collect fluid. When you have really advanced kidney disease, you develop a bad taste in your mouth for some patients. But some patients can go down to functioning as low as 10% of their kidney function before they have symptoms.
All right, Hanu, what were your symptoms? Why did you need a kidney transplant?
Well, we have a genetic issue in our family. It's called polycystic kidney disease. And my biological dad died of it because back in the late 60s, there was no transplantation in India. I knew about this because I got tested. There's four people in our family. Two of us tested positive and two of us tested negative amongst our siblings. So I knew about it from, 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. And there's not much you can do except for just follow a healthy lifestyle and stuff like that. And then, watch and see how your kidney function is slowly deteriorating. And then it gets to a point where, things get serious. Mm-hmm. And then it gets to a point where, just like Dr. Chandraker was saying, you feel really tired, and eventually you get on dialysis. which is all sorts of fun. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you hope and pray you can get a transplant.
You can be, that you're one of those 12,000 operations.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And so this genetic problem, that this happens what when you're like in your 40s, 50s? When does it?
It depends. It depends a lot on different families. In our family, it, you know, it usually manifests itself around age 50. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we're seeing in our family. Yeah.
Is that common?
Polycystic kidney mm-hmm. disease. It is reasonably common. It is not an extremely rare thing. A number of our transplant patients have polycystic kidney disease as a cause of failure. But as Hanu says, it is a genetic thing, and it's usually an autosomal dominant trait, although not always, which means that you have a very high chance of passing it on from parents to child. So it's usually identified in families, and people know that it's coming. Mm.
So this is something you just have to watch. You just have they do some sort of regular checkups to see how the kidneys are functioning, because you were saying you might not have any symptoms at all, right?
That's right.
Yeah. It's scary.
Actually, as long as you know about it, you can prepare yourself mentally, and that's how that works.
So did you have any physical signs? I mean, did you have any symptoms?
So because they were following me very closely, I knew when to expect the symptoms. And yes, I did have those symptoms. You know, it's... And especially when your kidney function really decreases tremendously when you're on dialysis, you feel it. Yeah. You definitely feel it.
So what would be some of the other reasons that kidneys begin to lose their function?
So the number one cause of kidney failure is a complication of diabetes. So not everybody who has diabetes develops kidney disease, but about a third of the people who do have diabetes will develop kidney disease. And that's true nationwide. And because of the increase in rates of diabetes throughout the country, there's also an increasing rate of kidney disease. You can also have autoimmune diseases like lupus that can cause kidney failure, and something called glomerulonephritis, which is a whole range of different diseases, but basically it's when the immune system attacks the kidney. And then polycystic kidney disease. Sometimes the people who have complications of repeated urinary tract infections, also side effects from medications and complications like that.
So how long can a person live without a functioning kidney? And what are the options? I guess we talk dialysis or transplant. So how do you choose between the two?
Right. So when you develop truly end-stage kidney disease, you cannot survive without adequate kidney function. And then you have a choice of going on to dialysis, which consists of the hemodialysis, which is the machine which cleans the blood, where you go three times a week, or the peritoneal dialysis, which is an exchange of fluids into the peritoneal space, which is in your abdomen. And you can do that at home, but you do it on a daily basis. Then there's kidney transplantation, which is an alternative. We are very fortunate with kidney disease in that there is dialysis, so that people can safely wait for a transplant and be on dialysis. For other forms of organ failure, that isn't so true. Mm-hmm. So at least you have that option of doing that.
How long can you be on dialysis? I guess it depends on how far along you are in your deterioration.
Correct. We have a number of patients who've been on dialysis for many, many years. But the dialysis takes its toll on people, and transplantation is a much better treatment for kidney failure than dialysis. You have a healthier life and you live longer. So it does depend on your other medical conditions and how you're doing on dialysis, and it doesn't suit everybody. And therefore, we always say that transplantation is the best option for those who are medically fit to be transplanted, because it will prolong your life and you'll have a much better quality of life.
I know you mentioned you were on dialysis until you got your kidney transplant. How did that impact your life with work and home?
So the way dialysis works is, as Dr. Chandrika was saying, I was doing peritoneal dialysis, which meant that I had to do a manual exchange a day, which took about an hour, and then I would do 10 hours of dialysis at night, where I was hooked up to a machine. And you know, what that basically means is you're tied to a machine. I used to always hook up at 9:30 at night and go till 7:30 in the morning. And you had to follow these real clean procedures at home. And you know, it was limiting. Even if I went up to, I had started a new job, going up to Boston meant that I had to carry this huge machine with me wherever I went. And and you were also very tired, even with dialysis. Yes, you were, you know, it was keeping you alive, but your quality of life was not the same. You were definitely feeling the effects of dialysis. Yeah. And compared to that, after my transplant, for instance, you know, I feel amazingly well.
Yeah. And the engineer in you came out with this because you know this. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, one of the issues we always have is, you know, what I tell all my students is, you know, look at, whenever you're designing a system, look at it from an end-to-end design perspective. And if I have one message for those people who design dialysis machines, it's, you know, if you look at a dialysis machine, the kind that I was using, it's just 2 inches too large to fit into a carry-on suitcase. Mm-hmm. Okay, so if we could get into a carry-on suitcase, it would make life so much easier.
Two inches.
Yeah, and I think we can do that. Yeah. So, of course, it's easier said than done. You know, they have lots of experience with the machine. It has to pass FDA approval. There's all these issues. But it would be nice to have something that's small enough to fit inside a carry-on suitcase.
Dr. Chandraker, kidney donations you mentioned come from living or deceased donors. So let's start with the living donors. What's involved with finding and matching living kidney donors?
So, you know, we used to be a lot more restrictive when it came to living donation, in that, you know, you had to be matched both for the blood group, and also you also had to be matched in terms of making sure that the recipient was not sensitized towards the donor. In other words, wouldn't have an immediate reaction. And so there was a lot of concern about also matching for closeness of matching. In other words, when you transplant, as I said, identical twins are completely matched. So brothers and sisters or siblings will be 50% matched on average. Parents will always be 50% matched because you get your genetic material from, you know, 50% from each parent. So we used to try and get closer matches. You know, we'd go for a 50% or higher match initially. And then we found that actually matching was not as important as it used to be. The ABO, or blood group matching, is important. But the other matching isn't so important because we have now stronger immunosuppressive medications that can overcome these, as we call them, mismatches. And also, if you're ABO incompatible or your recipient is sensitized, it doesn't matter so much because we now have swap systems that occur throughout the country. So you may have heard of some of these transplants where you have these chains where one person will donate, and then the person who's going to donate to the first person originally will donate to somebody else. So you set up these chains of, mm-hmm. you know, 10, 12, 18 transplants. And so what that has done is that by creating this pool, it means that more people can be transplanted. So as long as you have a living donor, it is highly likely that you'll be able to utilize the donor either for yourself or for somebody else, and that you would then get transplanted from a different donor.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the blood type. Type O the toughest to match?
Type O is the toughest to match.
And that's, of course, you.
That was me, right. And then, you know, so if I look at our family, my sister got a kidney transplant from my mom 3 years ago, and she's doing really well. And because we knew about this, we talked about it throughout the family. And when it was my turn to get a transplant, unfortunately, my wife couldn't donate to me. I had a cousin. He was an O, but he couldn't. He was a mismatch with me. And then, and of course, the other interesting thing, which Dr. Chandraker will have some interesting opinions on, is, you know, when they first did my blood type, the questions they asked me were you ever pregnant? Did you have a blood transfusion? And I said, no, not that I know of. I called my mom. I said, did I ever have a blood transfusion as a kid? She said, no way. And, you know, I already had some antibodies, and we quite couldn't figure out why. Oh. And so that made matching a little hard. So we had, you know, it was an emotional roller coaster. You know,
sure.
You start off by saying, yep, you know, within the family, there's three or four people who are all ready to step up, and they were, and each one of them failed to match. And, you know, and then I'm quite an extrovert, but when it comes to something like this, it's a tough ask. So, yeah. You know, you don't want to, you know, I was telling people about it, but I was not asking them. And it was wonderful right here in Woods Hole. A couple of our friends came to the table. Actually, three or four of them came to the table. And unfortunately, each one of them, a couple of them, the ones who came to the table were all O's. And they just didn't have a good match. And so then we were looking at, as Dr. Chandraker pointed out, a swap option. And my brother was eligible, and he signed up for a swap. And unfortunately, it's still hard to do a swap for O, because what winds up happening is people who have O2O matches tend to go to their own relatives, whereas people who have a different type and then want to swap to an O, it's a much harder way to go.
Boy, it's very complicated, isn't it?
It can be.
Yeah. We're talking about kidney transplants. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about kidney transplants with Dr. Anil Chandraker, Medical Director of Kidney and Pancreas Transplantation at Brigham and Women's Hospital and President of the American Society of Transplantation, and Hanu Singh, who underwent a kidney transplant last summer. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Let's talk to David, who's calling from Hyannis. Good morning, David.
Hi, good morning. And hi, Dr. Chandraker. Thank you very much for hosting a lovely dinner a couple of months ago.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. I just wanted to offer my perspective on donation. I'm a live donor. I donated to a family member almost 3 years ago. I did very well with it, and I'm an active person and healthy. Obviously, I wouldn't have been able to donate, but I'm an airline pilot by trade, and I just wanted to mention that I didn't have any difficulty regaining certification with the FAA to fly again. And overall, it's been a very positive experience. I would, however, like to talk a little bit about the finances, if you don't mind.
Absolutely.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, the finances were tough, quite frankly. And I had the ability to, I purchased short-term and long-term disability insurance through my work. But right up until the week before donation, it was a close-run thing as to whether or not donation would be considered a covered event. And so, absent that coverage, it was worrisome whether or not I would be able to budget, you know, up to 3 months of downtime. And I'm hopeful, and I've tried to introduce legislation that if you offer disability insurance in the state of Massachusetts, that live kidney donation would be considered a presumed covered event. So that's one hope for. And the other would just be better tax incentives for donation. Because right now, it's a pittance, and the ability to budget 1 to 3 months of downtime is difficult for many people.
Yeah.
The only other thing that I found to be challenging with the donation was actually being out of work for 6 weeks and just not being able to resume the activities that I enjoy. But that was fine.
Yeah.
Physically, I've done great, and so has my recipient. He's doing very well. So overall, a wonderful experience. I'm hopeful that in Massachusetts and in the country at large, we can create better incentives for people to donate.
David, thanks for the call, and thanks for bringing up those points.
So, I mean, you know, people like David are the real heroes. I mean, going out, donating a kidney, is really an amazing thing. And, you know, every time I see that, I get a little choked up because they're doing something for somebody else that they don't have to do. And it's a very unusual field in medicine in general that you're putting somebody through surgery, not for their own benefit, mm-hmm. but for the benefit of somebody else. And it really speaks to the altruism of these people. I think on the issue of financial donation, I totally agree. We at the American Society of Transplantation have been working on this issue on a number of fronts. Certainly, one of the things that we've done is talk to major carriers about compensation for donors, and not in the sense of buying or selling kidneys, which we are definitely not in favor of. But, you know, somebody donates their expenses, and the expenses can be covered. And that's something that can already be done. But what we're doing is we're actually encouraging health insurance companies to cover that, because it's actually much cheaper for them to do that than to pay for ongoing dialysis, which is a very expensive therapy. So one of the things about transplantation on the financial side is that it is also a cheaper option. And that you recoup the finances of taking care of people with end-stage kidney disease within a couple of years of being transplanted. And after that, you're saving money. Now, considering that end-stage kidney disease is 6% of the Medicare budget, it's a significant chunk that needs to be taken care of. On the other side, we've actually wanted to go further and provide for lost wages. Right, because we don't believe that is compensation. We believe that somebody who, like David, is giving up time and may not be being paid by their employer, they should at least get some sort of potential reimbursement for those lost wages. Because at the end of the day, we want to maximize people, maximize the number of people who are able to be living donors if they want to do that.
Why couldn't we put it in like family leave? You know, when you have a baby or you adopt a baby, mom and dad can take up to 3 months. Why couldn't we put it in some?
We certainly could, and we would all be in favor of that. One of the complicating factors is that NOTA, which is the legislation that covers kidney transplantation, is very clearly states that you cannot, you know, compensate somebody for a kidney in the sense that you cannot buy a kidney. And of course, we agree with that. However, unfortunately, it has led some to interpret that as not being allowed to reimburse. Mm. So it is a bit of a gray area, which has caused some consternation. But, you know, from our reading, and I think from most legal experts reading, it's not an issue in terms of making a donor whole, which is what we like to say, mm-hmm. In terms of reimbursement for expenses.
Yeah, and on that note, Dr. Chandraker, one of the other interesting issues is, you know, healthcare coverage for the donor as opposed to for the recipient. Because usually, a lot of hospitals follow them for 6 months or a year, but after that, they are on their own. And, you know, that seems like another area that would be nice to somehow cover.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. And I think that, you know, while living donation is very safe, it cannot be 100% safe. And we do not know over the lifetime of somebody, if there will be a very small percentage of people who may have health problems, which may or may not be related to donation. But, you know, I agree that if you donate and you have problems related to donation, that should be covered. It becomes, again, a gray area as to who should pay for that and which bucket does that come out of. At the moment, we are mandated to follow our donors for 2 years at a center. However, there is no real ability to get the money reimbursed. So I think if there was a mechanism to do this, then I think it would be great. You'd get better follow-up. And people are looking at various different ways of doing this, creating a registry. Mm-hmm. I know that that's something that's been talked a lot about. And so I think it's possible. I think the other thing is that, you know, what we find is a lot of our living donors feel so great and healthy that they don't turn up for their for the checkups, and they should.
Yeah, and you know, and the point, of course, that we should not forget is, I think, and you know, I've seen this in my case, and I strongly believe in this. I think all the medical centers are very conservative when it comes to accepting live donors. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't want to have two problems instead of one.
Right.
So they draw that line pretty sharply, and that's a good way to go.
Yeah. Right. What about deceased donations for someone who's died?
So deceased donations is an area that, you know, we've been slowly pushing the envelope in terms of trying to have more deceased donors. In the past several years, we've been utilizing what we call more ECD or extended criteria donors. And, you know, those are from older donors or donors who have a history of hypertension, where, you know, they're not ideal. And certainly, you know, living donors who have bad hypertension or other medical conditions, as Hanu said, would not donate for two reasons. One is the harm potentially to themselves, but also because we want to make sure that we are, that the recipients get a good kidney. And also things like donation after cardiac death. Traditionally, we've taken kidneys from brain dead donors, so there's a diagnosis of brain death, and then people are eligible to be donors. But donation after cardiac death is a newer criteria, and there were some concerns about doing this because, you know, the patients are not so stable, and so there's concern that there'd be more damage to the kidney and it may not be viable after donation. But people have been gradually pushing that envelope, and we've had very good success with that.
Mm. How long after death can you use that kidney? I mean, I would imagine you got to get to the hospital pretty quick, right?
Right. So generally speaking, most people would have a cutoff of 24 hours. But it also does depend on other issues. Again, you know, the quality of the kidney. There are times where you'd extend that time if you had a very good kidney to beyond 24 hours, but generally 24 hours is taken as the cutoff.
Yeah. Let's go back to the wait list. Hanu, you were on the wait list. How long were you on the wait list?
I was on the wait list for 2.5 years.
That had to be just an emotional roller coaster. I can't even imagine what that must have been like.
Yeah, you know, and I think there's two issues there, right? One of them was the fact that originally I was always thinking, oh, I'm going to get a live donor. I have so many people lined up. They're all ready to donate. And unfortunately, you know, every time we heard, oh, sorry, this one didn't work out. This one didn't work out. It was a blow. And then I think even during those times, especially when I went on dialysis, I think a lot of the pressure went on my wife. You know, I was coping as best as I could, but she had to take over, you know, the whole family. She had to deal with the doctors. She had to deal with the, you know, with the insurance agencies. So I think, you know, your spouse or significant other definitely takes a huge toll on them.
Okay. And also looking at the statistics.
Right. Right. And, you know, I'll be quite honest. What happened in my case was I was waiting and I looked at one of the interesting issues is there are, I believe, 58 different areas within the U.S., which are, you know, donation centers or OPNs. And the reason they're divided into 58 different areas like that is they don't want the organs to travel very far. Kidneys can travel quite a distance because you can transplant them, as Dr. Chandrekar said, 24 hours later. But hearts and lungs, you want to get them in really quickly. And so typically what winds up happening is that if someone's donating all their organs, they want to line up the heart recipient, mm-hmm. the lung recipient, and the kidney recipients. But the kidney recipients, for good reasons, are last on that list. And so I remember, you know, we were 2.5 years in. I was looking at the list, and we had decided to list ourselves in multiple areas. And the reason we did that is there's a different wait list time in different areas. Mm. It's a function of how many people are on the list, how many recipients you get. And so, you know, it varies. The criteria, of course, is that when they make the call, you have to be there in X number of hours. And so in some ways, it's actually unfair because if you're well off, if you can afford a private jet, for instance, to mm-hmm. jet all over the U.S., you can list yourself as many places as you want. Yeah. And the places with the shortest time, which are usually, you know, in the middle of nowhere, comparatively, as opposed to, say, Boston.
So you're looking at direct flights. Where can I get a direct flight right
exactly.
away?
Exactly. Where can you get a direct flight? And that's the big issue. In my case, we, you know, decided. There's another issue, too. You know, you need to spend another 6 weeks after transplantation right there being taken care of. So you need that whole support structure. Mm-hmm. And so in our case, we decided, of course, we went to Brigham and Women's. It's one of the best hospitals in the world for transplantation. We went to Vermont, which is also a really good place and close by and has a much shorter wait list. And we also went to and cross-listed in Missouri, where my sister is, where I would have some support there as well.
Wow. So how does this wait list, who gets priority? How does that work? Is it really who's next in line, or is there's a lot of other factors?
So on the wait list, patients get allocated wait list points, and the majority of points are given for waiting time. So the vast majority of people get to the top based on their waiting time. However, people who are sensitized, which means that they have preformed antibodies, which means that their ability to accept organs is decreased. So if somebody is, let us say, 99% sensitized, it means that they will not be able to safely take a kidney from 99% of the population. So in order to make sure we can be fair and transplant those people, we give them extra points so that they will get closer to the top. So people who are 100% sensitized, which obviously doesn't make sense because you're not quite 100% sensitized. You can always get a kidney from an identical person who has identical HLA. We'll get priority. And if we didn't do that, there'd be patients who would never get transplanted. So we, as a community, reorganized the kidney allocation system in December of 2015. And what that meant is that there's more equity so that there's less of a difference, as Hanu said, in traveling between centers. And certainly within the region, a lot of this disparity has disappeared because we are able to more evenly distribute the kidneys. There are still parts of the country where you have a shorter wait list than you do on the coastal areas. But most of the people get points because of wait time, and then they come to the top of the list and they get transplanted.
Yeah. And I know you mentioned that there's a seasonality to this.
Yes, you know, so, you know, we're scientists, so we're watching all this. And, you know, I'm not a medical doctor, but the great thing about being a scientist is once you figure out what's going on, you try to dig into the details. And you know, when I look at both Brigham and Women's and Vermont, the two centers that we were seriously considering, we were looking at how many transplants they made as the year went along, because you can see those statistics. And I remember talking to somebody at Vermont, and I'm saying, you guys claim you do 25 to 50 a year, but, you know, it's April, and you've done 5. And what's going on? I mean, is this a really bad year? And she said, no, most of our transplants take place either in summer, because unfortunately, when you think about deceased donor transplants, most people die working outside or in traffic accidents or stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And so in the winter, they're indoors, the chances are much less. And then you see a spurt all through summer. And then it slows down again in the winter. And so that was kind of interesting. And you know, that also is when I got all the way through August and I realized that I was not close to the top of the list, or I thought I wasn't close to the top of the list, I said, oh, I'm going to have to wait another year until next summer.
But you didn't.
I didn't.
Yeah. So how does the wait times in the U.S. compare to other countries?
So it's very variable. The U.S. has some of the longest wait times. There are regions of Canada that have longer wait times, in Toronto, for example, but other parts of Canada do not. But if you compare the wait times in the U.S. to Europe, Europe generally has lower wait times. In fact, in the United Kingdom, they've actually been decreasing their wait times by using more of the donation after cardiac death donors. And in some places like Spain, there's virtually no wait time because they've been very aggressive at changing their donation policies.
And this would be, instead of here where we opt in, you have to opt out in Spain, correct?
Correct. So in Spain, what happens is that it is assumed that everybody upon death would be an organ donor, and that you opt out of that if you do not want to be a donor. And what has happened with that is that it's increased their rates of donation. In the United States, it's an opt-in. You have to state that you're an organ donor, you know, either on your driver's license, depending on which part of the country you are, or making some sort of declaration. Of course, the family of a potential donor will be reached if in the situation, even if a person has made no declaration whether they're a donor or not, but it does have some effect on the likelihood of somebody donating. And this is why we encourage everybody who wants to be a donor to actually make sure that they do have that designation on the driver's license.
Yeah, and you know, one thing I would add, looking at all my experiences, if to all your listeners out there, you know, if there's one thing you can do, you know, just seriously consider being a donor, organ donor, and having that in writing somewhere. Some people say a Facebook post is enough, but definitely in Massachusetts, you could be an organ donor by going to the RMV and signing up, you know, because it would make a huge difference in someone.
Well, one donor can save 8 lives, I read?
They can save 8 lives, but they can impact many more because the tissues from corneas, bones, tendons are used actually in there's some donors who actually help literally hundreds of people. But yes, 8 lives if you talk about the solid organs.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about organ donation, specifically kidneys this morning. We're talking with Dr. Anil Chandraker. He's the medical director of kidney and pancreas transplantation at Brigham and Women's Hospital and president of the American Society of Transplantation, and Hanu Singh, who underwent a kidney transplant last summer. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to add to our conversation. 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So you have a campaign called Power to Save. Tell us about that.
So the Power to Save is a brand that the American Society of Transplantation started a couple of years ago. And the reason that we've started this is really to sort of become better advocates for our patients. You know, the reality is that transplantation is viewed as a success, and it is, of course, a success. But, you know, if you take a child who has a kidney transplant in childhood, they're likely to require 2, 3, sometimes 4 transplants throughout their lifetime. And so one of the things that we are really looking to do is to continue research in transplantation and to raise money and raise awareness of this. Because although it's a great success, it could be a lot more successful. And there are a number of things that, you know, we wish to do. We wish to sort of, one of the things is there's an immunosuppression bill in front of Congress at the moment. So patients have immunosuppressive coverage for their immunosuppressive drugs for a number of years after transplant, but it's not lifelong. And so it's crazy. You transplant somebody, all of a sudden their coverage for their immunosuppression stops and you will see a decrease in the number of kidneys that are surviving. So this is something that doesn't really make any sort of financial or fiscal sense. But there are areas like this, and particularly with research, that we are very keen to sort of expand and create better medications and better care for our patients.
Yeah. Anu, your family is from India, and some people suggested you return to India to get a kidney transplant. Tell us why.
So, you know, as you look at transplantation all over the world, there are certain places where, you know, the rich and powerful have an edge. And my family is definitely well-connected in India, and so are all my friends. And they said, oh, just go to India and get it done. And yes, there are laws against blah, 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 but you can always find a donor. And, you know, there's lots of reasons not to do that. There's, of course, the ethical reason, which is that it's just not the right thing to do. Okay. And I think even in India, they're trying, and in other places, they're trying to make sure that there's a much more equitable way of distributing kidneys. So, you know, that's the way it should be. You know, you need to wait your turn, and that's how it should be.
So what's happening internationally? I mean, how are we addressing that?
So, I mean, I think it's, you know, the United States can play a very great role in this. I mean, I think that the system that we have here, although not perfect, is a model for many other places. And you know, the improvements that we can make, as we've discussed already. But, you know, I think it is true. I mean, organ trafficking is a big issue in many different parts of the world. It's something that, you know, we're vehemently opposed to. Having said that, you can imagine that somebody who's living in a country where dialysis is both an expensive and probably not a reliable form of therapy, that people are desperate to get transplanted. So, you know, you have to look at it from both sides. You have a family member, you know, who will die if they don't get transplanted. It leads people to do very desperate things. Mm. So the reality is that, you know, we have to play a useful role in all of this. We have to increase deceased donation in many different areas. There's an organization in India, for example, which is a not-for-profit organization called the Mohan Foundation, Mohan Foundation, which is basically building up the infrastructure to allow deceased donation to occur in India, which is not being done by the government in a meaningful way. And they've been very successful at increasing the number of deceased donations. And of course, that takes the pressure mm-hmm. of people who, you know, want to feel that they have to go out and buy an organ or mm-hmm. do something extremely unethical.
Right. And, you know, there's, again, as with lots of things, there's a slippery slope. You know, for instance, it might make sense for me to go to India and get a legal donation through a blood relative, just because it's easier for them to, you know, do it in India as opposed to move all the way here. But that also comes with a cost, because, you know, there's a blanket statement by all American doctors saying, look, we're not going to take care of patients where we don't know the doctors on the other side. Mm. And so you get transplanted in India, you better stay in India and get care there. Yeah. And so there's two sides to that coin. Yeah.
We mentioned families would be approached, even if you know you have it on your license that you're an organ donation. Those are some difficult conversations.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, you know, it is a difficult conversation. The people who do it are very well trained. They know how to approach families. And, you know, it's been shown that the trained coordinators who do this for the organ bank are very, very good at doing this. And, you know, it is surprising that sometimes by offering this to families, it is in some small way a relief to them to know that their, you know, loved ones have not died in vain. So it is, you know, it's a critical piece to in the kind of medical care that we can sort of provide within this country. And it is you know, a community thing, right? Mm-hmm. Donors and recipients, it shows that we're all connected.
Yeah. Now, normally you don't get to know who your donor is, correct? I mean, sometimes people do connect.
Right. So the general thing is that, you know, it's not advertised. If a recipient family wishes to know, they write to the organ bank, in the New England Organ Bank, or New England Donor Services, as it's now called, and they will ask the donor family if they wish to be contacted. And if they do, then they'll put them in touch.
Mm. So do you know where your kidney came from?
I know roughly where it came from, but I don't know anything about the family.
So walk us through that experience that once you got that word, because, you know, you had these disappointments, as you were saying, with your relatives, and then, oh, we think we have this, and no, it's not a match. And then you get this word, we've got it.
And, you know, I'll be very honest with you. I know everybody in my family was very happy, but I felt a little tinge because though I don't know who my donor was, I know my donor was about 27 years old. Uh-huh. And so some poor person died. And that, you know, and you still have that little feeling which says, oh no, some poor person, you know, they probably had family too.
Right.
And how are they going through this? Meanwhile, I'm almost, you know, I'm feeling very happy, but on the other side, there is that feeling that, you know, some poor person has had a big tragedy on the other side.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine that's common in your patients, a little bit of guilt that they're when they have a deceased donor.
No, absolutely. And I think that's, only natural. And it is a difficult situation. And sometimes patients do feel that very strongly.
Yeah. What's the recovery time for this? I mean, did you feel better right away?
I thought I felt better right away, and I did. You know, it makes a huge difference. And, you know, it's a few weeks, and then there's follow-ups. In my case, like I said, I got transplanted in Vermont. We stayed there for about a month, and then we used to commute up once a week. Unfortunately, in my case also, I developed a complication, and I had blood clots in my lungs. You know, that led to the fastest trip that I've ever done between Falmouth and Boston, 58 minutes, hospital to hospital. And, of course, I didn't enjoy it. I was in the back of an ambulance. But otherwise, it's been, you know, there's ups and downs, but it's been
But you're feeling good now?
Oh, I'm feeling great right now.
Yeah. When a person receives a kidney transplant or another organ donation, he or she needs drugs to prevent the body from rejecting the organ, right? So explain why the body would reject the organ and how these drugs prevent that from happening.
So, I mean, this is a very good question. So why would you have a reaction against somebody else that you've never met? What was the purpose of that? Well, the immune system is actually designed to eliminate foreign material, and usually this is in the form of bacteria or viruses or fungi or, you know, other infectious processes. But in order to do that, the body actually has a system where it recognizes self, and everything that is not self is foreign. And everything that is foreign, it has a reaction to. And this is why you have a reaction against transplanted organs. Immunosuppression basically suppresses the immune response so that you don't have these specific reactions. One of the issues is, and one thing that's very fascinating about this, is that the amount of immunosuppression, if you look at Hanu, he looks healthy. Nobody would guess that he had a transplant. He doesn't live in a bubble. He goes out, he shakes hands with people with runny noses and survives. And the reason is that the immune system is very adaptable. And just like the immune system can recognize your own tissue, after a while, it develops a response against a transplant. Now, it doesn't mean that you can do without immunosuppression, but what it means is that we can use doses of immunosuppression that are not very high, so you can lead a normal life and work and look healthy and feel healthy and do great.
And with all the stuff that's going around this winter, do you have to be extra careful?
I was explaining that to my nurses who were giving me this lecture. They said, okay, stay away from crowds. And I said, do you know what I do? And they said, what do you do? I said, I lecture 50, you know, college students. Half of them have colds all winter. So, you know, my standard deal was I told everybody in class, I was like, look, I just had a transplant. If you have a cold, it doesn't mean you can't come to class. Please come to class.
Sit in the back.
Sit in the back. Yeah, just give me this virtual bubble of 3 feet if you have a cold.
Right.
And they all are very very open and sympathetic.
Are there potential side effects for some of these rejection drugs?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And so a lot of the work that I've worked on in my lab and others have is to induce a form of tolerance whereby you wouldn't need these immunosuppressive drugs. The immunosuppression itself has many side effects. And this is why, in fact, one of the side effects of one of the most commonly used drugs is actually to cause kidney failure over the long term. And so this is one of the reasons that kidneys do not survive for the lifetime of an individual. Mm. And this is one of the other reasons that we do need to create new medications and drugs and transplantation. Very successful, but there's always a price to be paid.
So what are the odds of a successful kidney transplant today? And is it different than it was, you know, say a decade ago?
Oh, yeah. I mean, a decade ago, yes, slightly. But, I mean, if you compare it to 20 years ago, it's vastly different. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, you know, we have kidney and patient survival in the 90% range at 1 year. And many people go on for many, many years, depending on the type of organ they get, et cetera. But, you know, for a living donor, I have a number of patients who are out 20 years plus.
Wow. So what happens when your body does reject? And, I mean, do these drugs always work? I'd imagine sometimes they don't. What happens if your body rejects the organ that you've been, you know, had transplanted?
So if your body rejects, then you can become sensitized, and the chance of getting a second transplant, you know, it becomes harder to match somebody. The other problem with the immunosuppression is, of course, cancer, because your immune system is suppressed and you can get infections over the long term. So, yeah, we'd really try to keep the kidney from rejecting, but eventually it will do. And after that, you do have to have, you know, sort of specific management as to when you withdraw your immunosuppressive drugs and how quickly can you be transplanted again. But, you know, we encourage everybody to be retransplanted.
So you may need another transplant somewhere down the line?
I'm not even thinking about that. I'm just enjoying it, and that's the way I am right now.
I will say the longest surviving patient I have is from 1969.
Oh, wow. Now, earlier we discussed ways that would reduce the wait time for organ donations in the U.S., and one would be to make the organ donation an opt-out instead of opt-in program. Do you see that as something that might happen here in the coming years, or is that a tough sell?
I think it's a tough sell. I mean, I think there's all sorts of legal barriers to be able to do that. I think in Europe, the legal system is different. It's based on a different form of legal practice, which sort of makes it easier to do this. But I think it's also that I think within the United States, people very much want to do the right thing. And so it's hard to know. I mean, I would favor an opt-out system, but I think it's not always worked in different parts of the world where they've had this opt-out system, where it is assumed that you'll be a donor, is actually led to a decrease in the number of donations. So I think you have to be very careful about this. I think the most important thing is having these conversations about donation, making sure that as many people are donors as possible, and, you know, and being open to it if people are ever in that situation, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think education is the answer. You know, it's just like blood donation 30, 40 years ago. It was a big deal. And then people got quite used to the idea. And now, you know, we have, hopefully, we have close to enough blood donors. Right. If we can somehow get the level of education on cadaver donation up as well, then that would be a good thing.
And a lot of people have a lot of misconceptions about organ donation. And we have, like, less than a minute, but I just want to put that out there, that if people are curious and they have questions, they can contact, what's it called now, the New England donor?
Well, I think they can contact, there are many different organizations. They can go to the website of the American Society of Transplantation. They can go to National Kidney Foundation. They can go and look at a New England Organ Bank. UNOS is another resource. There are lots of resources out there. They can contact the my hospital as well.
And get the answers. Okay. Yeah. Dr. Anil Chandrakar and Hanu Singh, thank you both for being here. I'm so glad you're doing well.
Thank you so much.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.